Hi there, folks. You're listening to CITR 101.9 from the unceded Musqueam Territory in Vancouver. We had a little bit of a schedule change. It's supposed to be Asian Wave starting right now, but we're actually going to be having an hour of science podcast instead. First, we're going to be starting off with Artem and Andrew's podcast from their Jobs in Science, and that can be found at www.jobsinscience.ca. And it is on the Grass Pods website. And as well, this episode features Rosie Redfield, a UBC professor. And then we'll have Christine's podcast with Marie Kondo and Varsha Rani discussing undergraduate research in science. So we'll be having that coming up in a few minutes. Stay tuned. And as well, at 5:30, we'll continue scheduled programming. It's going to be the UBC Caribbean African Association, which I just incorrectly put as something different. So I just wanted to clarify that that's what their name is. So that'll be coming up in just a few minutes.
Science interview series. I'm Andrew Chapman.
So, but you are now confident that it works?
I am confident that it works now.
I'm confident that it's hearing us.
So that's our guest for this episode. And there's actually a pretty funny story about why she seems pretty skeptical of my ability to use the recorder. You see, I went to go visit her for the interview, and we had a really great chat for like an hour and a half. And I leave, and I realize I didn't record it. I didn't get any of it. But got up the courage to email her back, and she very graciously agreed to do the whole interview again.
I can't say, oh, he was an idiot.
I mean, you wouldn't be wrong.
I would never make that mistake. Oh, dog.
And so I just like to thank her for redeeming my first interview for the GISIS podcast. But you're probably wondering who she is.
I'm Rosie Redfield. I'm a professor in the Department of Zoology. My main jobs are to teach. I teach genetics mostly online, and human ecology, and to run a research lab.
So for Rosie, I went to visit her at her office at the University of British Columbia, and I had been told beforehand that she had pink hair. But she didn't have pink hair. It was turquoise. And it might be a bit cliché, but it quickly became apparent that this is a reflection of her individuality in the science world. Rosie has a unique perspective on work in science. And we actually reached out to her for an interview largely because of her dedication to openness in science. She believes this approach allows for better research, and at one point it led her to challenge results from a pretty powerful research organization known as NASA. So you hear all about this story and other stories from Rosie about her career in science, so make sure to stick around and check it out.
Initially, as I was finishing high school, I thought I wanted to be an engineer. And that was not, I mean, I didn't have much idea of what engineers did as engineers, but I had some idea of what UBC engineering students did, and that looked like a lot of fun.
Okay.
And I knew I was smart enough to do it. So that was initially I wanted to be an engineer. And then I, of course, changed my mind and decided I wanted to go to medical school. And that lasted until I studied molecular biology. So this was in the early 1970s, and molecular biology was so exciting that I found myself thinking, if I wasn't going to go to medical school, I'd really like to do molecular biology. And then this little epiphany where I said, oh, wait, I don't have to go to medical school. I could do molecular biology.
So Rosie started her degree at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. She says at the time it was the new hip school in the city, and so she started taking some courses there.
And then I got very, very distracted by the 60s and Turn On, Tune In, and Drop Out and did all of those things. And a few years later went back to SFU to... having by that point decided, oh, I want to go to medical school, and started taking the biology courses that I hadn't paid attention to the first time around. Mm-hmm. And then, luckily for me, my husband had taken a postdoctoral position in Australia, in Melbourne. And I say luckily for me because, I mean, I was a typical Vancouver teenager. And it had never occurred to me that I'd want to live anywhere else. You know, it was really nice here. Why would I go anywhere else? And it was moving to Australia that opened to my eyes about how cool the rest of the world was.
She then did a master's in Ontario at McMaster and a PhD at Stanford, which is definitely pretty impressive. But at each step, she kind of does something that I think a lot of people do as they're kind of navigating their career. She started to question her own abilities.
Most of the time, it was just the, am I good enough to go on decisions? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it might be sort of reassuring to listeners to realize that when I started, I didn't know how far I was going to get at all. I'd say, well, I'm going to go to university. Let's see how I do. And then, you know, as I was going to university, I discovered that I was doing pretty good and eventually decided I was doing well enough that I should consider graduate school. And then I started in my master's program and, you know, I wasn't at all sure where that was going to lead. But after a while, I said, oh, actually, okay, I'm pretty good. Oh, hey, I got into Stanford. Oh, this is scary. I don't know if I'm going to be good enough to be any good at all at Stanford. Maybe they made a mistake. And then I got to Stanford and said, oh, okay, I'm not really any worse than anybody else. In fact, I'm better than some of them.
And at Stanford, the fact that she questions herself actually led to a decision that changed the entire path of her career. She switched labs. And it wasn't because she didn't get along with her supervisor or anything. It's because she didn't think she was getting the education that she was actually looking for when she first went there.
One of the things I did in my second year, I was on the committee that actually evaluated applications from students who wanted admission to the graduate program. And Stanford It wasn't that they thought our judgment was so great, but they got a lot of applications, and the faculty eased the burden by having the grad students do the initial screening of all the applications, kind of sorting them into a good enough to be considered and don't even bother pile.
Okay.
And at that point, I decided I'd better check my judgment by going back and reading my own application to Stanford to see if I would admit me. And that two things came out of that. One was that I decided, yes, I would have admitted me. That was good. But the other thing that happened was that I read the you have to write a letter, like a short essay about why I want to go to grad school, why I want to go to Stanford. And when I read my essay, I realized that I'd gotten distracted into a lab where I wasn't really learning the things I needed to learn. That I was learning sort of details of science, but I wasn't learning how to be a good scientist.
Okay.
I wasn't really learning how to design experiments and interpret experiments very much. And so I decided I was in the wrong lab. And that came kind of as a flash. Oh, I'm in the wrong lab.
And so she switches, finds another less famous lab working on bacterial genetics in order to learn how to be a good scientist. And that change stuck. She continued doing bacterial genetics, and that's where she found the question that she devoted her whole career to, what a research lab is all about now.
I decided to study whether bacteria had sex in the sense that plants and animals, eukaryotes, have sex.
She says this is an important thing to study in order to better understand why plants and animals have sex. And from her work, she really strongly believes the answer is no. Bacteria aren't having sex. Genes can move around and they can be passed between bacteria, but Rosie doesn't believe this is happening to increase diversity or anything.
We think that bacteria are just taking up DNA as food. They're just eating DNA. And sometimes by accident, the pieces of genes wind up in their chromosomes. But I'm the voice crying in the wilderness. And
right.
This is not what most microbiologists think.
So how does that feel? Is it frustrating?
Well, it's definitely frustrating because I'm pretty damn sure that this is actually the right explanation, but it is extraordinarily hard to change people's minds.
And she says a big part of that comes down to one thing.
Sex is really glamorous and food is really boring. There's charismatic problems and questions like, oh, genetic exchange, bacteria are having sex, bacteria are talking to each other, they're making group decisions. Those are very glamorous ideas. The ideas, no, they're just eating DNA and they're not really talking to each other, they're just feeling out their environments. Those are not glamorous ideas.
Right.
And it does affect how likely ideas are to be accepted. And certainly, journals want to publish glamorous ideas. Everybody wants to discover glamorous things.
And it's actually this line of thought in a lot of scientists that catalyzed possibly one of the biggest moments of Rosie's career.
Oh, this is another case where other people thought they had discovered something really, really glamorous and exciting. And I was maybe the first to say out loud, the emperor has no clothes. You guys have got it wrong. This is not exciting. This is drab and dirty and dreary. Some listeners might remember a big news story in December of 2010, announcing that researchers funded by NASA had discovered almost an alien form of life. They'd discovered a kind of bacteria that could make DNA out of arsenic instead of out of phosphorus, like normal DNA. And that even though these bacteria actually lived on Earth, this was the kind of biochemistry you might expect from space aliens. And this was NASA was super excited about this, and they had a big press conferences, and it was in all the newspapers saying, oh, on TV, we got to rewrite the biology textbooks. And after a couple of days, I got around to reading the research paper. It was published in Science, a very prestigious journal. And I got around to reading the paper, and I said, wait a minute. This is really sloppy science. These researchers cut all kinds of corners. They were not careful. They did not use extra clean reagents. They didn't even wash their glassware extra clean. I don't think this result is likely to be true. And I wrote a blog post where I laid out in meticulous detail all my concerns about this paper. And I only had one Twitter follower at that time. But there were some people who read my blog who had more Twitter followers. Mm-hmm. And the result was that this blog post, this criticism of the paper, went viral. And I had like 100,000 hits on my blog in a week, which is super exciting. And the feedback from other scientists was, oh, she's right. Look at this. Look at this. We don't believe this either. And eventually what happened was that I went on to try to replicate the results of the scientists. Basically, they'd grown bacteria in culture medium that they hadn't added any phosphorus to. They'd only added arsenic. And the bacteria grew, and they made DNA, naturally. And when the researchers analyzed the bacteria's DNA, they found some arsenic. And so they concluded that the bacteria could make DNA with arsenic instead of phosphorus. And the reason that they found arsenic in their DNA was because they hadn't taken pains to get their DNA really clean before they tested it for arsenic. So basically, I grew the bacteria and showed that, in fact, the growth was explained by contamination. And so we got a paper in the prestigious journal Science, too, in which we said, doesn't work. And it's mostly a story of, I have a slide where I show the cascade of fail, considering why such a totally wrong result was so exciting and was treated as if it was so important and so successful, published in a very prestigious journal. And it wasn't that there was one big mistake. Rather, it was this great series of mistakes that everybody involved with the research made. The researcher, who was a junior scientist, she was basically a postdoctoral fellow, made the mistake of falling in love with her hypothesis that bacteria could use arsenic and not testing whether she might be wrong. She never seriously considered, how would I know if I was wrong? Her supervisor didn't carefully check. He trusted her judgment too much, I guess. The other authors on the paper just said, oh, well, you know, we're happy to have our name on the paper, but we're not really responsible for the quality of the data. Mm-hmm. And the reviewers of this manuscript were super credulous. They read it and they went, wow, oh, this is so exciting. Wow, this is great. Oh, you missed a comma on page 3. Basically, they were so uncritical in reviewing the research. And then, of course, the editors of the journal probably screwed up, too, in choosing these reviewers. And NASA, of course, had a lot of egg on their face when the paper has never been retracted, although everyone knows that it was wrong. But the authors never admitted they were wrong. Huh. And that, to my mind, that makes them bad scientists.
Right.
Making mistakes doesn't make them bad scientists. We're not just working at the frontiers of science. We're working at the frontiers of our ability to do good science. We're trying as hard as we can. But we all make mistakes, and sometimes we're unlucky, and we make them really publicly. Mm-hmm. And nobody really judges scientists too harshly for making mistakes publicly. But if they can't admit they've made mistakes, then they're a failure as a scientist.
I think a part of what made Rosie's role in the NASA story so big was her dedication to doing science openly. She believes that science ultimately works better the more open we can be. And one aspect of this is using open access journals.
I think that's That's really important in terms of allowing our science to benefit people. When I think of like people who are dealing with serious diseases and they have to travel all the way to a university library just to do research about the disease that they're dealing with, and it's terrible.
Unfortunately, posting in open access is expensive, and with funding down these days for basic research, it's often not a completely viable option for a lot of labs.
Yeah, I mean, how many enzymes could you buy with what you have to pay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's the prestige side, and there's the, if I publish in this journal, I have to pay the cost of publication out of my research grant.
Mm-hmm.
If I publish in this journal, they basically get the cost of publication from the libraries that subscribe to it. But I get to keep my money, and I can use it to, you know, buy enzymes or pay for isotopes or even top up the stipend of my grad student. So it's, you know, when I had lots of money, I was, it was always open access journals.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we're nearly broke, it's like, open access, I don't know if we can afford that.
Right, right. So at some point it becomes an actual cost benefit.
Yeah, it becomes actual practical. I mean, that's true for most things that we do, I guess.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, this is a particular example where ideally I would do it this way.
Right.
But I can't afford to do it this way.
Like everything in life, there's a moral balance that becomes a decision maker for you. One of the big things she's known for is posting her experiments and her results on her blog as she's doing them. And I think this really helps to limit some of the problems with always publishing in open access journals, because it allows the public to see what you're doing at any time, not just after publication, and also because it holds you more accountable to your work.
Mostly because when other scientists know what we're doing, we have a better chance of doing good science. Also because I sort of think like, you know, the taxpayers are paying for this. They should be able to find out what I'm doing. So my blog, the blog that I published the arsenic criticism on, is actually an open research blog. I write not just like most science bloggers about research that's already been published. I mostly write about the research that I'm actually doing in my own lab. I do this partly in the hope that other people will say, Here's I have information that will be useful to you. And sometimes that happens, and it's really great when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And partly just to set an example of being open. One of the reasons I went ahead and did the attempt to replicate the arsenic experiments was because I was going to do them openly and report on them on my blog as I did them. And this was an opportunity to do open science when people would be watching. I'd been doing open science for, 5 or 6 years at that point, but nobody was really paying any attention.
Right, right.
And by doing the arsenic work openly, this was a situation where I knew people were paying attention.
Watching this. So, I mean, what is your response then to people who say that it's the competition that drives the science rather than a more collaborative kind of outlook that you have?
Most people get that idea from their supervisor. And I think supervisors and the students overemphasize the likelihood that someone's going to steal their idea and underemphasize the benefits of writing openly about your research.
Mm-hmm.
And there's partly it's sort of the ego thing of thinking, oh, my ideas are so great, somebody's going to want to steal them. Most of the time, you can't cram your ideas down someone else's throat. They don't want them.
The last thing that Rosie and I talked about caught me by surprise. She brought up the gender gap in science and engineering, and it kind of makes sense that she would bring it up so naturally, while I really hadn't given it much thought. It's subtle, more than it used to be, but over time, it plays a major role in the steps that women take in a career in science.
I mean, women in science, I mean, women generally in any field that's traditionally male-dominated get a lot of sort of subtle subconscious, we don't get a lot of conscious negative messages anymore. Oh, you can't go into science. You're a woman. You should just get married and have babies. We don't get that anymore. But there's still a lot of sort of subconscious devaluing of women's contributions anytime it's a contribution in a field or in an area that's dominated by men. Women's contributions are usually devalued. Mostly just in very small ways, that each individual thing isn't ranked or considered quite as high. And it's not just men that do this. It's all of us, men and women. We don't take as seriously contributions from women. And so really, to succeed as a woman, you have to be better than the men around you. And you also have to be fairly ambitious and fairly confident. Mm-hmm. If you're easily discouraged, you're not going to go on in science. You'll look around you and say, oh, no, I don't really feel like this is the place for me. Right. And it won't necessarily be any particular thing that anyone says. Just the general, you know, you look in the textbook and most of the pictures are of men. You look in the journals and most of the authors are men. You go to the seminars and it's mostly men talking. And you just gradually get this sense you don't belong. Right. So unless you're good and ambitious, you won't stick it out.
Right.
And so when we point to, we can say, oh, look at this woman scientist. She's evidence that women can be really successful. But of course, that's the really, really, really good women who are in those positions. And other women look at those women and we think, I'm not that good a scientist. I mean, I'm a pretty damn good scientist, but I'm not that amazingly good.
Right.
How can I, you know, how can I succeed? But it's helped a lot that we have, which we didn't have when I was young, we have actual quantitative measures of what it takes for women to succeed, what it takes for men to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Like actual studies with data, not just opinions, not just anecdotes, but data. And the data is quite depressing in that it shows that subtle unconscious biases are playing a really big role in determining how well women's contributions are valued, how likely it is for a woman to get a job, to get a grant, to get research, big research space, all of those things. In general, women's abilities aren't valued as highly as men's abilities.
Do you think even at this stage of your career that this is affecting your job?
Yeah. I mean, I've just put in, over the past 5 years or so, I've put in 8 proposals to the Canadian Institutes of Advanced Research for major research grants. And not one of them has succeeded, even though they've been, by the judgment of everybody, they've been very good grants.
Right.
They've almost succeeded a number of times, been really close to the cutoff, not quite.
Hmm.
I'm quite sure that even though for any one proposal, I can't say, you know, if I'd been a man, it would have been different.
Yeah, yeah.
But over 8 proposals, I can say, yeah, if I was male, there was a male name on those grants, probably at least one of them would have gotten funded by now.
Right.
I really think that. So this, it comes back to, you have to really love doing science.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't, even knowing all that I know now about implicit bias, I would still be a scientist. It's just really, really fun.
So that's Rosie. I really think that the theme of this episode and of Rosie's career is just being more open. And I think that great things can come from that. I've always thought that. But it would be great to get some feedback from you guys. And the more that I thought about it, the more that I realized that that's really what Rosie's doing in all aspects of her career. She's kind of just taking the lead from the bacteria that she studies. Just taking up information from your surroundings and then seeing what you can do from that information.
So we're
on iTunes now, so definitely make sure to check us out there and subscribe. You can get the podcast on your device. And if you don't mind, leave us a review. I've heard on the other podcasts that I listen to, apparently it helps other listeners find us. So that would be that'd be pretty cool. Also, make sure to keep checking out the website. It's grasspods.com/jisis, J-S-I-S. And we're on Twitter at PCR Jobs. Artem's the man behind the wheel at that one, so definitely give him a shout. And make sure to check out the next episode. It's an interview.
This is CITR, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam land.
You're listening to 24 Hours of Student Power, 100% student content all dang day.
Featuring student band Melt and Cheap Flavor live in studio.